Done daily clicked it. Done I have 55 it. Minutes of recording time left on this microphone. Well, I'm going to delete stuff soon.
We better hurry it up. Oh, my goodness. Hey, Willow.
Yeah?
Do you know something?
What?
Did you know that there is no ethical consumption under capitalism?
Wow, really?
You heard about this? You hear about this?
Yeah.
How about a spooky story in which that's kind of the moral?
Really? Is that what that was trying to say? Because I came out of this story just like, this is a gay man who ran away with his lover after they both faked their deaths.
I mean, fair. I think that guy faked his death, though. I think he shot himself in the head and was dying in a bed for 2 months.
I don't agree.
Well, speaking of disagreements, what is this show and what is it all about?
This show is...
Wait, that's not how we do this at all.
That's not how we start the show at all.
I'm Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And it's Del Toro time.
Del Toro time. It's Del Toro time.
It's Del Toro time is the name of this show. I'm Phil, your Willow. We've been doing this show for years now. We are barreling towards the end of The Dark Descent by David G. Hartwell. We are closing in on the end of A Fabulous Formless Darkness, the final section of said collection of short stories that we started to do because watching movies got too hard during COVID.
It wasn't even during COVID. It was after COVID.
There's no such thing as after COVID.
That's true. There's pre-COVID, and then there's shutdown, post-shutdown.
Right. One of the things that got hard, I realized, was that it got hard during work from home, which has never ended. Mm-hmm. Like, it used to be that I would meet you and we would watch a movie in the living room, but now there's always people here. Like, this house is never empty. So we just, finding ways to watch movies together got so difficult that we were like, let's just read a bunch of stories. That's a little backstory on why we're continuing to do these short stories instead of watching our Guillermo del Toro movie list.
We'll get back to that after this.
We will get back to it after this. This story, though, is a nice primer for one of our soon-to-be-watched movies because we are watching eventually an Edith Wharton adaptation. I believe it's the next movie after this one, after our next one. After the Albert Brooks comedy we watch, we'll be watching an Edith Wharton period piece. No spooky movies coming up unless you count Nightmare Before Christmas, I guess.
You always count Nightmare Before Christmas. Have you seen this man?
The scariest movie ever made. He's the Oogie Boogie Man.
To be fair, the movies that gave me nightmares as a kid were Lord of the Rings and The Goonies, so...
The movies that gave me nightmares... What did movies give me nightmares? The movie that gave me the only really nightmares as a kid was Halloween. And I didn't even see the whole movie. I only saw like a few minutes of it, but the parts I saw were enough to terrify me. Were they parts with the killing? No, they were parts where Tommy runs into... No, not Tommy, the bully kid, whose name I can't remember, played by Anthony Michael Hall in the latest movie, runs into Michael Myers outside of the school. Like, just runs into him and like looks up at him and then runs off. And for some reason, that moment just seared itself into my consciousness and I couldn't sleep for like 2 weeks. Also The Ring, but that was for totally different reasons.
The thing that like consistently made me unable to sleep was the Bloody Mary episode of Supernatural. You want to know how I got over that? I forced myself to watch it 600,000 times.
That's how I got over Tori Amos's Little Earthquakes being a trauma listen for me because a girlfriend of mine introduced me to it and then I couldn't listen to it without sobbing. So I shut myself in a closet and forced myself to listen to Little Earthquakes over and over again until it stopped making me cry thinking about her.
Heck yeah. We have healthy coping mechanisms in this household.
It wasn't even my closet. It was the theater closet at school.
Nice.
So, yes. Why can't we get into the theater closet? Phil's in there crying over little earthquakes. In any case, good album. Yes, this week we are covering Afterward by Edith Wharton, the much anthologized short story Afterward by Edith Wharton. Willow, what can you tell me about Edith Wharton? Anything?
Only what is written in the paragraph on this page.
So what is the paragraph? What does David G. Hartwell have to say about Ms. Wharton?
She's one of the great American writers. She's a realism writer. I should have pulled my novel theory book out, and then we could have been really boring this whole time.
That would be awesome.
She's a close friend of Henry James, apparently.
Yes. Anything else? Any other bio information? Because I've got a few things written down, if there's nothing else.
Just some, like, interesting stuff about her writing. Wharton gives us a character portrayal in the... Wow, I can read. Wharton gives us a character portrayal of meticulous clarity and substantial psychological depth. While I was reading this, I did note that the style that she writes in is one of my favorite styles that I did learn about during my fiction class. But the type of realism she uses is one that I like.
Not unlike the writing of Henry James, in the sense that it's deeply psychological. And so it's no surprise that they were like such good friends. So Edith Wharton was an American writer. She was born in New York City in 1862. She's the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. With the novel The Age of Innocence, which we will be discussing, because there was controversy about the Pulitzer that year, The Age of Innocence. There's a whole story behind it. And of course, we're covering the movie The Age of Innocence eventually, so we'll get into it then. But she wrote about New York aristocracy, which, because she was born into New York aristocracy, like American aristocracy in this era was kind of like, there was a lot going on with it. It was very much like the end of Victorian era, the beginning of this purely American sense of the middle class, the upper middle class, and what did it mean to be an aristocrat in America? Like, it was very different than what it was in Europe. But in addition to writing The Age of Innocence, she also wrote The House of Mirth. She's known for the novella Ethan Frome. And she wrote a bunch of spooky stories. With Afterward being just one of them. And I was thinking about this today. I was like, it's really difficult to honestly and psychologically write about American aristocracy without it being a spooky story, without it being a horror novel. Like, if you're intellectually honest with your readers, your story is going to be unsettling at the very least. But so, she was friends with Henry James, who we've covered. Also Sinclair Lewis and Jean Cocteau. So she was kind of like this central figure in like the intellectual elite. Henry James was her mentor and a critic of her work. So he helped shape her narrative techniques and also the social observations she made in her writing. She was married to Edward Robbins Wharton, which was a source of deep personal anguish for her because of his mental health issues. They eventually got divorced. She moved to France after the divorce.
I wonder if that impacted her writing at all.
She moved to France, embracing a life of literary and social freedom that was denied her within New York societies. She traveled throughout Europe. Became a huge success. She broke barriers in her as a woman, both in her personal and professional life. Her friendships, her marriage, her expatriate life, and her engagement with the intellectual currents of her time all contributed to the depth and breadth of her writing.
She wasn't a eugenicist, was she?
I do not believe she was any more a eugenicist than your average American elite. I can't say for certain, but I did not find...
That's good, because...
Okay. Hold on one sec. Was Edith Wharton a eugenicist? Question mark? There's too many articles have popped up. There's one called, oh man, there's a lot. Maybe I'll have to look further into these because there's whole things about race and imperialism in Edith Wharton's writings, debility and disability in Edith Wharton's novels, invisible blackness in Edith Wharton's New York. There's a discussion about this. I think it's because a lot of these topics overlap and you can't discuss racism or disability without getting into the history of eugenics.
I just know that there's, like, especially in early feminism, there's not a small overlap between that and eugenicists in history.
Yeah.
So I was just curious.
Yes. So I guess the trick is discovery, kind of like when you find, like, deeply problematic stuff in H.P. Lovecraft's writings, and you have to be like, okay, which of this is deeply problematic stuff because H.P. Lovecraft was just a deeply problematic human being, and which of this is deeply problematic because it was entrenched into society at the time, and people didn't even think about it. It was just accepted as common knowledge. So as we get into Wharton, we'll have to look at that, especially as we get into Age of Innocence, which is more about social mores. So,
I just wanted to think about that just as a lens of potential stuff.
A potential lens. So this story, what does David G. Hartwell have to say about this story? Anything interesting?
It is essentially a story about perception and the nature of reality.
Okay. I mean, that's one way of putting it.
Afterward is indeed in the manner of De La Mer.
Okay.
He says the character portrayal thing about it. But the events are unsettling and ambiguous enough to impel the story over the border into our third category. What?
Our third category. Fabulous Formless Darkness. The category of...
I thought he was talking about... What was that word that I thought was made up that turned out to be a real word?
Bosoms?
No, that's a real word. I really like that word.
Bratwurst?
Horror appellation. Horror appellation.
It's like dingleberry. I don't know. What is a word you thought was made up? Perception and nature of reality. Yes. Psychological depth. Substantial psych. But it is interesting, and it does fit into this category because it is that thing where it's like, we know something weird is going on. It's not just like, is this all in your head? But it is like something strange has occurred. There's a solidity to the presences here. But it never gets explained what it was. You just kind of feel bad about it at the end. She certainly does.
I guess.
There's a weird thing going on in this story. Well, okay. Edith Wharton, afterward. Not afterward like...
This is the story that has two versions as well. There's two versions of this story. I didn't get to read the differences because the thing disappeared before I got the chance to.
It expired before you got a chance to. But don't worry, I'm going to cover it really quick. Okay. So this story originally appeared in what's it called? I have it pulled up right here. Don't worry, everyone. The January 1910 issue of The Century magazine, which I looked up. And it's pretty much the version. Well, okay. So it appeared in 1910. It was published for the first time in a book in Tales of Men and Ghosts, an Edith Wharton like collection of like spooky stories. And then it's just been anthologized in just tons of short stories since. Like, it's never not been anthologized in Ghouls and Ghosts, 13 Geister Stories, Famous Ghost Stories, 13 Famous Ghost Stories, Roald Dahl's Book of Ghost Stories. Just all, everyone likes this story. It's just sort of a quintessential examination of the purpose of the ghost in ghost life. But what's interesting is, as we have discovered in so many of the stories in The Dark Descent, the version in The Dark Descent isn't necessarily the version you're going to read if you pick up just any copy of this story. In fact, the differences are so substantial that I actually entered it into a program to chart the differences between the versions. And so what you're looking at here is a chart. This is just one chapter in the story because it's divided into five parts.
Yeah.
So every highlighted part is a change. And,
oh boy.
And so already, see, this is mostly cosmetic, like, or words or so. Instead of saying loitering about the different quarters of her demesne as if Spring were already at work there. The original version said as if Spring were already at work on shrubs and borders. So this, so the version on the right is the is the original version. I don't know why they got flipped. But the version on the right, the original version is a lot more wordy. And so originally I was like, oh, I wonder if some editor just simplified all this. But you get further into the differences. You're like, okay, there's a lot of changes here, a lot of changes. Oh. And then you get here. Because a plot element in the story is completely altered. The pivotal moment in the story, the opposite thing occurs. Like the exact opposite of what the main character does in the Dark Descent version happens in the original version. And it's reworded and reworked so expertly that I'm like, oh, this must just be a later edition she did. She probably went back and cleaned it up for publication, was like, ooh, this will make a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. But the only reason I discovered this is I'm on the exercise bike at the gym, listening to this story, and I have the book in front of me, because one of the best ways I can do to read a short story quickly is to listen to it and read it at the same time. That way, both of my processors are going at once. Mm-hmm. And I'm following along, and I'm noticing, like, all these words are different. But I'm like, okay, obviously she did some editing later on. And then it hit this section, and I was like, wait, what? Like, I couldn't even follow it. I'm flipping back and forth trying to find what part of the story we're even on. It was mind-blowing. I went home and I just did my research. And as always, there's no indication in The Dark Descent that this is a different version of the story. We've seen this happen time and again. There's different versions floating around out there. I can't find any information on it. So anyone listening to this, if you know anything about the different versions of Afterword by Edith Wharton, please explain it, because I can't find any scholarship or anything on it. In any case, we'll get to when we get to that part in the story, I'll explain what happens, because it changes the perspective only slightly, but also completely. Like, it's really weird. It's a tiny plot change, but it's has massive repercussions about the end of the story.
If it's the scene that I'm thinking of,
you'll have to see. So, Willow,
let me break this down chapter by chapter as I
break it down now.
Forgive me, I am one of those freaks who writes in their books with pen.
That's okay. I'm not going to resell it.
Yeah, no, you're not. I actually have a second copy of this book as well. So I made note after each chapter of my thoughts on what I thought was happening, because I thought that would be fun. I miss school, apparently. but the first chapter starts with Mary Boyne and her husband, Ned Boyne. They're looking for a house to move to. And they're talking to, I guess, their friend or real estate agent.
I think she is a friend and realtor. I think in the television adaptation of this, it's made clear that she's both. And they're Americans. Living
from
in
America.
England. Yeah.
Americans from America.
In fact, from the American Midwest. There's a lot of dealings with Waukesha, Wisconsin. Yep. Which in the BBC adaptation, they keep pronouncing Waukesha. And I'm like, nope. I don't believe people are really from Wisconsin.
they're looking for a very particular kind of house. They want an old house, like a proper old house. And they want it to be haunted.
And they also want it to be rustic and no lights or water.
They're like, we know it's proper old if it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because they want to get away from, like, the hustle and bustle and into, like, the simple life.
Because they're newly rich.
Yeah.
And they make this big deal about the fact that they don't want to live lives of luxury. They want to work. They want to be doing something with their lives now that they don't have to worry about money anymore.
Yeah. It's like, because she wants to, like, paint and he wants to write a novel.
Yeah.
They're very insistent that it's actually haunted, because every good house is haunted, obviously. And Alita's like, well, there is a ghost in this one, but you're not going to know it's a ghost until afterwards.
Yeah.
Story name drop immediately.
Yep.
And they're like, what does that even mean? And Alita's like, oh, you know, you'll know when it happens. Except for you won't until afterwards.
It's also important to note that the whole story is in essence a flashback, because it starts with her in the library of the house thinking back on how all this happened.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a weird ghost. They make a point of like, the house is well known for being haunted, but also like no one cares because there's not a specific story attached to it. The ghost is so ephemeral that you're like, there's no famous ghost. It's just, you'll see a ghost, but you won't know it's a ghost for months. And then you'll figure out it was a ghost.
My favorite line of this story is one of Ned's on the second page when he says, life's too short for a ghost who can only be enjoyed in retrospect. That's awesome. Hell yeah.
Here's the funny thing. I like Ned in this story. You learn things about him later on, but she does a really good job at making Ned and what's her name? I can never remember her
Mary.
Name. Mary. Just kind of an affable couple. They're just kind of they're kind of nice people. They're kind of fun and just, they have a good sense of humor with each other. They play around a lot. They're just.
I got really irritated with Mary. Mary? Yeah.
How come?
I'll get to that when I get to it.
Okay.
They're like, maybe we can do like better, but they end up moving into this house, because it's the best one they have available. The best one is the worst best one.
Right. It's deeply uncomfortable, dark, but it's taken care of. It's not like falling apart.
Yeah. Ned was originally an engineer, he either worked for or owned Blue Star Mine.
I think he was an investor in it. It's kept vague exactly what his dealings were. But
that is intentional because we only know as much of the situation as Mary does.
Yes.
And Mary doesn't know anything.
Right. Much to her embarrassment.
Yeah. She makes it. She's like, I've always been like unhappy with the idea of like an American wife not knowing about her husband's dealings. But God, is it boring.
Yes. Yeah. He's like, and he's just like, you know, I've tried to talk to you about this, but it's just not, it's not interesting.
Yeah. And she's like, yeah, I'm embarrassed, but yeah. Also, he wants to write a book on the economics basis of culture, which sounds interesting. Also sounds really boring, but it sounds interesting.
And apparently he's written the intro and he's written an outline and she's read it and it's like, yes, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I was constantly surprised by they set up a few things that you think is, I'm so used to your The Shining-esque, like.
That has to have been intentional because of all of the other stories that we've read with like the down on his luck, like writer being like haunted by his writing. There's a part where the first part where she's like, what could he possibly be so anxious about during his writing? And I was like, that has to be it. That has to be intentional.
Yeah. Things that only writers would write.
Yeah.
How old do you think these people are? I could never get a handle on that.
I think they have to be either in their like mid to late 30s. I don't think they're that old. I think that if they were any older than that, they would have settled down in a nicer place. They're still like they're not so young that they're like frivolous with their money, but they're not so old that they just want to retire and live like a whatever life.
Right. And she does talk about how like they've been together long enough that they're kind of tired of like, for so much of their marriage, she talks about they've done a lot of like standing dinners.
Yeah.
And like eating on trains to it, like, because his job just required them to rush around a lot.
Yeah, like they're past the like rush of your 20s, but they're not. Like they're in the prime of their lives.
Yeah. And they'll look back on these days and laugh.
Oh yeah, that's what they'll look back on. the first chapter, she like goes through like their original moving in, and it goes on to talk about like how he's been like kind of off.
Yeah.
Just like anxious and concerned and whatever. And she's recalling, she's trying to figure out why. She's standing in the library, planning on doing some of her own work, and she's trying to like think through what could possibly have caused this. And she recalls a memory, not long after they moved in, or I couldn't really tell the timeline there, but she recalls a memory of her and Ned seeing a man from like an opening in the attic.
Yeah, she discovers a secret passage that leads to it's like I thought it initially was like a widow's walk, but I think it is inside the attic. But it's sort of a place
like
to
a
just
hatch.
Go and
yeah,
yeah. You look out and you can see like the countryside, and it's a really cool place to get a good view.
Yeah. And she and Ned both see a gray figure, like man, like walking towards the house slowly.
Yeah.
And Ned rushes out to go do something.
Yeah.
And when she gets back, when she goes to find him, he's back in the library, just like anxious. And he's like, he vanished by the time I got there.
Yeah. And he's like, I thought it was one of the workmen who's doing work on the house. I was trying to grab him before he ran off. By the time I got there, he disappeared.
Yeah.
And she's like, he wasn't moving that fast, but okay. And then they just kind of forget about it.
Yeah. And
or she kind of forgets about it.
She does, yes. And the chapter ends with like her being like, oh, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would he be anxious if he thought it was Peter's?
Yeah.
And here's what my thoughts were, what I was like, this is my theories on what's happening so far. My first one, your husband is either in debt or he's gay.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, so either this is happening or this is happening.
Why not both?
That's exactly what I said on the next page after reading some more of it. So that was my theory on what was happening. I was like, either your husband's in debt or he's gay, or he's dead. Like, either your husband maybe is the ghost.
Oh, I see.
And then my other one was, surely writing a book can't be that anxiety inducing. Just because I was like, it was very refreshing to read that after all of the anguished authors that we've been reading.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a dose of humor that I really liked.
Yeah, there is a wry sense of humor about this story. But nothing in the story is treated lightly. In fact, it has a pretty devastating ending. But so we established that they've seen you said a gray figure. Yeah, it's literally a man in a gray suit.
Yeah.
Walking through, which isn't helped by the fact that her husband also wears a gray suit.
Yeah, and immediately once chapter two starts.
Because she thinks she sees this figure again, and it ends up just being her husband.
Yeah, which I thought was great, because I was like, that's foreshadowing for something. I don't
or
know what
something.
It's foreshadowing
yeah, yeah,
for,
yeah.
But that's definitely foreshadowing. And this is the part where she kind of irritated me just a little bit. They have a conversation, where she explains that she thought he was the ghost, and he's like, that's absurd. Like, I forgot the ghost was even like a thing. And she's like, well, have you been looking for it? And he says, no, I don't really care. And just the way she goes, have you, like four times when it increasingly irritates him. I was like, if somebody did this to me, I would be so mad. I would just be so frustrated.
She's walking kind of not on eggshells, but there's something strange going on. There's a weird feeling about the place, and neither of them, or she doesn't have any clue what's going on.
Yeah.
She does receive in the mail a newspaper clipping, though, that gives a hint as to something happening with her husband back in America.
Yeah.
And
he also, before she receives that clipping, though, and after this conversation, he's looking at the mail and he opens a letter and he's immediately relieved.
Yes.
And everything
yes.
goes back to normal.
Mm-hmm. And she gets she sees an article about a guy. What's his name?
Ellen. Where is it?
What?
Elwell. You see how I got those.
I can see how you got this. So this guy, Elwell, something to do with her husband's dealings with this mine and this guy named Elwell. And then her husband's like, oh, don't worry about that. It's all taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
This guy tried to bring a lawsuit against me. I had helped him out. He tried to sue me. And she's like, what? Oh, wait, if you helped this guy, why did he try to sue you? And he's like, he probably got some lawyer got to him and tried to convince mm-hmm. him he could make some extra money. But don't worry. It's all in the past. None of this matters anymore. Like, that's all taken care of. Nothing weird. Just let it go. And she's like, okay, that's strange, but all right.
My comment on this section was debt, gay, crime. And then I circled gay and crime.
And as the end of the story will reveal, it's none of those three. No one's
all of those three.
Or all of those three. But what I find fascinating is, well, we'll get to that. So,
yeah.
So, husband had some shady dealings. Yes.
One of the things that I also wrote was hiding from the law, question mark. Like, maybe the reason that her husband initially wanted to get out of town was to put some distance between that situation and himself. Which mm-hmm. I think makes sense, because if what is maybe revealed to have happened at the end of this did happen, I think it makes sense.
I don't know. We're going to have to get there. So let's keep moving through this story,
yeah.
Because...
So they talk about the lawsuit, and he's like, it's all right. It's great. Everything is great. The third chapter...
This is the big chapter. This is the one that I called out for the discrepancies earlier.
Yeah.
Not a long story, by the way.
No, it's only like, what, 20 some odd pages?
Yeah, you can read this in a single sitting, like in probably mm-hmm. like a half an hour or so. Like,
yeah,
it's...
it took me about 20 minutes or so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's a quick read.
It's a good read, though. I really like the mm-hmm. story. This chapter makes me sad.
So what happens?
She talks about like how things have gone back to normal, how like everything is great now. She's out sitting in the garden, and a man comes to the house looking for her husband. And she's like, there's something about the situation that, like, immediately sets her on edge.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, goodbye, get out. He doesn't want to see you. And then she feels bad, and she's like, well, if you came a long way, I guess he's in the library. Like, I'm sure he'd be happy to see you. And the man goes to the library, and she forgets all about it because she's meeting with a plumber?
Yeah, a guy who's taking care of some stuff in the greenhouse. There's a...
Yeah.
A worker, a handyman.
Yeah.
I like how she has this idea in her head of what this handyman is supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. And then when this young guy shows up, she's like, okay, this wasn't what I expected. But, and then she's like, oh, wait, no, it's not him at all. Whew.
Yep.
He doesn't look at all like this guy, I thought. So this is the moment that I was talking, that I was referring to.
Yeah, that's what
to.
I thought. Huh?
In the version that is in The Dark Descent, he shows up and is like, I'm looking for your husband.
And she says,
you an appointment?
Yeah.
And he says, I think he expects me. And she says, you see, this is his time for work. He never sees anyone in the morning. And the guy's like looking around kind of uncomfortable. And then she's like, well, have you come a long way? And he's like, yeah, I came a long way. And then she's like, fine. Go on into the house. My husband will see you. Like, you'll find him in the library.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's the way, that's the version that's in Dark Descent. In the original version, and the version you'll find in a lot of compilations, she says, have you an appointment with Mr. Boyne? And he says, not exactly an appointment. And she says, then I'm afraid, this being his working time, that he can't receive you now. Will you give me a message or come back later? And then the guy like lifts his hat, says he'll come back later, walks away, and that's it. She doesn't guide him to the house. She doesn't mm-hmm. tell him to go on into the house. She yeah. just sends him on his way, and he walks off and disappears.
Which I think this version makes more sense.
Right, because later on in the story, she even says, I pointed you out, I led him to my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't in this. Now, you can interpret it many different ways, but it's such a bold contrast. Like,
yeah.
It's very deliberate. It's not vague at all. In mm-hmm. one version, she says, no, you can't see my husband. He says, well, goodbye then. And she feels a little bad. She's like, I hope he didn't come a long way. Oh, well, and then goes on with her life. In the other version, she's like, fine, you may see my husband. He's right in the house, in the library.
Yeah.
The fallout's the same, but something just struck me as like, that's a very, two very different character choices.
And two very different stories in the end, I think.
In the end, yeah. And I find it just wild that this isn't discussed. This isn't like an Edith Wharton thing, like,
This version of the story belongs in the Fabulous Formless Darkness. I don't think the original version does.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
So, long story short with this chapter, she spends time with the gardener and the handyman. She goes in. She's like, whoa, it's late. My husband never came out for lunch. He's just gone.
Yeah.
The servants, there's all this business with the servants.
I feel so bad for the kitchen girl.
Because I love, though, how well she paints this image of, like, the kitchen girl had to go answer the door, which is, like, mm-hmm. totally not something.
Not her job.
And it's so not her job that when she's trying to talk about it later, she can barely find her words because her life is already in turmoil, having to do a duty that was not prescribed to her.
I feel that so much. Yep. Kitchen girl, autism coded.
She's just like, So what happens is Mary is trying to figure out where her husband is. And they're like, well, this guy came in. The kitchen girl told him where your husband was. He gave her a note with presumably his name on it, took it into the husband. They left together. We haven't seen him since.
The amount of time it takes Mary to put together the man from the garden and the man who came in to visit her husband drives me insane.
Well, that's one of the reasons it makes more sense for the original version, mm-hmm. just because she sent that guy away. Like,
yeah.
She sent him away, and then they're like, yeah, this guy came and visited your husband. And she's like, oh, really? Okay. And no one can describe him either. Like, yeah. That's one of the things. The kitchen girl is like, and she's like, oh, my God, I can't get anything out of this woman. What he looked like, which is also telling because she knows what he looks like, but he's kind of in shadow the whole time. A lot of criticism towards this story goes towards the fact that people are like, this is the ghost. Clearly, this is the ghost. This is a ghost story. This is a ghost.
They don't know it's a ghost story.
What?
The characters don't know it's a ghost story.
Right. And the people are like, why does it take her so long to figure any of this out? And I'm like, well, because she's not expecting it. And you don't know you've seen a ghost and so you've seen a ghost. Plus, she sent the guy away. Or she sent him away. She just doesn't pay attention. He's just some guy. Like, he's literally just some guy. He's a young guy.
And her, like, lack of recall, like, memory stuff is kind of it made clear in the first couple chapters as well.
Yeah,
Like, she just doesn't pay attention very much to things.
Yeah.
Did you get any weird vibes from Trimmel?
I think that Trimmel is just a servant. Mm-hmm. I think the point Wharton was trying to make with her or illustrate with her is, like, the servant doesn't care.
Yeah.
Like, this, she's like, you know what? This is outside of my job description. Mm-hmm. It's funny, though, because she talks about, like, having, like, an inside joke with Trimmel. She's like, oh, we always joke about this. But then as soon as she actually needs something from Trimmel, like, information, Trimmel's like, absolutely, I do.
Also, just, like, the scene that got me was Trimmel clearly has more loyalty towards the kitchen girl.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, because they're, like, same class, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
It's just the way that Trimmel, like, stepped in when the kitchen maid was, like, talking.
Mm-hmm.
Because she talks about how, like, Trimmel, like, takes over when the kitchen maid stops.
I guess I interpreted...
Comes up with a theory of how things, like, might have happened.
Yeah, I guess I interpreted that as just, like, Trimmel just trying to get the poor kitchen girl out of there.
Oh, yeah, no, same.
I didn't think Trimmel had any sinister...
No.
Motives. I
just think that dynamic there is also an important piece of the story.
Oh, yeah.
Because this story is told entirely from, like, Mary's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And her perspective seems very, I'm not going to say naive, but I feel like everyone else in this story is aware that something is going on and she's not.
Yeah, well, yeah, she definitely doesn't have a lot of all the information, and she's definitely put on blinders, because what ends up happening is cut to a month or so later, and the husband just never came back. And this wasn't, like, a small deal. Like, there was a search for him. Like, police searched the countryside. Posters went up all over town with his photo on them. He had always said it's impossible to get lost in England because it's so small. Well, he just walked out the door and never showed back up. And she refuses to leave the house. And her friends are like, oh, she's expecting her husband to come back. And she's like, no, I absolutely know my husband will not be coming back. The only thing that knows what happened to my husband is this house. Yeah. And the house ain't talking. And
I love that.
Yeah.
Because in so many horror stories, the houses talk too much.
But this also isn't a Hill House thing. What I love is that this house is just kind of like, I'm a haunted house.
Mm-hmm.
Weird things happen here, but it ain't my doing. This isn't like some random haunting either, because then the final chapter is when her husband disappeared, he was writing a letter and it was only half finished. And it was to a guy who we find out is a lawyer. And he's basically like, hey, Parvis, it's cool. Elwell's dead. And we don't have to worry about any. And then it, like, kind of cuts off. And she like is trying to figure out, it takes her forever. Again, it's the 1910s. No internet, no international phone calls. It takes her a long time to even figure out who Parvis is. But he swings by one day. He's like,
I was in the area.
He's like, I was in town. I thought I'd come by to pay my respects.
And also to devastate you.
Well, but he thinks she has all the information.
Yeah.
He's like, you don't know any of this?
She's like, why would I get newspapers from a billion miles away?
Right. Why would I know what's happening in Waukesha? And he's like, oh, I guess he just thought your husband would have told you all this. Because it turns out, not only is this a ghost story, it's a weird ghost. And this is what I find the creepiest thing about this story, is that the husband, you find out the husband had dealings with this guy, Elwell. I guess the Elwell was like, hey, here's a great investment. I've got all this money out or something. But her husband, who's a smarter guy, more like savvy, jumped ahead of Elwell and ended up making a mint off this mine while Elwell lost his shirt, lost everything. And as Purvis says, your husband, oh, don't worry, your husband didn't do anything wrong. This is just business. This is how business works.
Yeah.
Like he didn't even really do anything that unethical. He just did what people do. And this guy, Elwell, lost everything and tried to blow his head off. But he missed or didn't quite do it. And it took him 2 months to die.
Yep.
So he laid in bed dying of his suicide gunshot for 2 months. But then he died. Don't worry about it. He's dead. There's no lawsuit. That was all taken care of.
There is Elwell's family. He asks what she's going to do about them. Mm-hmm. And that's when the conversation starts. So it seems like there's articles and stuff being written about these two men.
She sees an article, and that's how she looks at this article that he produces, and it's got a picture of Elwell and a picture of her husband. And she's like, I can't even bring myself to read what it says about my husband.
Yeah, because the headline is Widow of Boyne's Victim Forced to Appeal for Aid.
Yes, because Elwell's widow and kids have no money now.
Yeah.
And that's what's gotten people talking again. And this guy Purvis is like, don't worry. It's all going to blow. It's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. Your reputation will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks at the photo of Elwell. And who does she see?
She sees the man who came to visit.
And she puts together that the first time they saw the gray figure was the day he tried to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the subsequent times was during his dying. And then he came to visit right after he had died.
Yeah.
And what I find so creepy about that is a ghost of a person who's not dead yet. And she's mm-hmm. She says he wasn't dead enough. He wasn't dead enough to come yet. And I'm like, that's gross and weird. Like someone not being dead enough to be a ghost, but enough of a ghost shows up across the ocean.
Yep.
Like,
this is one of those stories where I'm like, and now I want an extended, I want an entire short story collection based on stories based on people moving into this house and the ghosts that the house makes appear.
It is. It's a little bit Ju-on. It's a little Grudge because it's like a house that's like, hey, man, I'm just a house. Yeah, you bring your own stuff with you.
Yep.
But yeah, it's there's something going on in the house because we don't get any other examples.
Mm-hmm.
So this ghost shows up, this ghost of a guy that her husband wronged something and takes him away. Like he's just takes him to Goblin Land.
I really loved this story. I think why I loved this story so much was because it lacked so many of the themes that other stories have of people being haunted by their guilt, because it's clear he doesn't feel guilt. He's just yoinked away by a ghost because that's what happens, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But it's also about when I took economics in high school, we had this economic teacher who talked about how if you claw your way to the top and you step on people to get to the top, that's A-okay. Mm-hmm. That's how it works. That's how capitalism works.
Yeah.
You should not worry about who you hurt on your way up, because that is how that's the only way this society functions. He was not a cool guy. He looked like John Arbuckle, which was weird. He looked just like Garfield's owner, John Arbuckle. And he was nice enough, but I remember being really put off by him being like, it doesn't matter who you hurt as long as you make money doing it and as long as it's legal. And that's kind of the theme of this story is like, nobody did anything wrong. This isn't about a murder or an assault or like a guy like...
This is about living in the system that we live in.
It's about how you become the aristocracy. It's about how you become where they are. And she's like ignored it, her whole like relationship with this guy, like looked the other way, not bothered learning anything about his business dealings. And then she has it thrown in her face like, no, your husband was just as bad as everyone else. Not to you. He's not like a physical abuser. He's not a violent man.
What we get of the husband is a good man.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's a good husband. He's like, they don't have any kids. he's a good husband. He seems like people like him.
Yeah.
It's just in the system that they're in, the way that you get to the top is by doing pretty mean things to people.
And it's kind of that thing you're talking about with Trimmel, with the servants know this.
Yeah.
The servants are like, no, you're people who just lucked out and ended up with a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And the only people we know who've ever managed to do that are probably pretty gross.
Yeah.
So even though we've got some inside jokes together, I don't care what happened to your husband. Like, that's mm-hmm. not my concern. He's just another missing rich guy. And I found this story so creepy because of that. Like the notion that like this guy's doings caught up with him. Also the notion that like he saw the ghost as well and was like, and then the fact that he thought he was out, like he thought that he was home free because the guy finally died and nope, it's off to fairyland for you.
It's also that thing where like, even if the guy had lived, I think it's made pretty clear that the lawsuit wouldn't have mattered anyways.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I think the lawsuit was even withdrawn.
Mm-hmm. The lawsuit had been withdrawn.
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean that he didn't do anything
wrong. It just
shifty.
Means that it's, well, because we, even in modern times, we see lawsuits against rich people get withdrawn because the people who are suing them can't afford to fight anymore.
You don't have the money for whoever the lawyer is.
And clearly with Bob Elwell, that was also the case.
Mm-hmm.
My audio quality might decline at the end of this episode because I am running out of space on this microphone.
That's
I didn't
fine.
Realize I had so little space, but it's fine. It is a very good story. Is the ending any different in the original version?
No, it's worded a little different just because every paragraph is worded a little bit different, but it's exactly
the same. Does she still have the I sent him to Ned moment?
She does, which is why.
Okay.
Which is one of the reasons I assume that she changed it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, it changes the meaning of that line. Like, I sent him to Ned. Just that sense of, like, even if she didn't literally do it, that sense of guilt, like, oh my God, I should have figured this out. But of course, you don't know you're haunted. You don't know it's the ghost until months later.
Yeah. And I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I love when everyone is aware of the rules, but they can't do anything about them.
Right.
Because it's so easy to be like, well, obviously that's the ghost. First of all, we're reading a story. We know what the genre of the story is. The characters don't know the genre they're in. Second of all, we're not confined by the rules of the ghost.
Yeah. Also, it's that sense of like, you do something you know might be wrong or mm-hmm. unkind, but time passes and nothing bad has happened to you and no one's ever called you out on it. Everyone seems to have forgotten it happened. And then like one day it gets brought up. And like mm-hmm. all your guilt or all your shame or whatever comes crashing in on you. And it's like that only as a ghost. It's that sense of like, I didn't even realize how bad I felt about this at the time.
Yeah.
Now I feel bad about it. Like that, just like it's going to happen afterwards. It's not going to happen in the moment. You're going to be haunted. Yeah. This story has so much to say about class, about... the reason I said no ethical consumption under capitalism,
mm-hmm.
he didn't do anything wrong legally. He followed the rules, But a man got killed because of it. And hey, man, that's the nature of the game. That's what my economics professor would have said. He would have said, doesn't matter. You did what was right for you. You got your money. You got paid. Not your fault he took his own life.
It's a frame of mind that the people who, I don't want to say are able to succeed, but are kind of able to succeed as like billionaires or millionaires. Yeah. Not even millionaires so much anymore because of how the economy is, but
right.
But like billionaires and stuff, they have to have that frame of mind. Otherwise they would be crushed by the guilt of what they do.
Yeah. So this short story, very popular, was adapted into a episode of Shades of Darkness, which was a BBC series that showed in America on mystery on PBS, 1983, starring Michael Shannon, but not the famous Michael Shannon, a different Michael Shannon, and a woman named Kate Harper as the couple. And I watched it, and first I was like, why do I know these people? And Michael Shannon is in the movie Little Shop of Horrors. He plays a television reporter who says to Seymour, he's like, what happened to the greenery? Somebody get the plant food. And I'm like, hey, that's that guy. And then she is in Tim Burton's Batman as a television reporter who comes on after the first news anchor dies from the Joker's Smilex gas. And I was, after I knew that, I was, that's all I could see. However, they're both also theater actors. They both do a very good job. It's a very, very faithful, very well done episode. It's not scary, but it's unsettling, and they really sell the character. He really fleshes out a lot of the character. They're a little older than I envision, and he's a little more taciturn, but I buy him. Like, the only thing that I would complain about is that every time the ghost appears, creepy ghost music plays. It's kind of like, which kind of like gives it away that like what you're seeing is the ghost. But everyone's great in it. It's on YouTube. I highly recommend checking it out. It's an hour long and totally worth watching. It takes longer to watch than it takes to read the story. But it's shot in a real like beautiful old like. It's shot in like the house. Like it looks just like you imagine the house looks. Catch you watching that.
Apologies for my audio quality having decreased greatly.
That's okay.
I still like my gay interpretation.
Or he was gay and he ran away with his lover who faked his own death by shooting himself in the head and laying in bed for 2 months.
My theory, I mean, I know it's not true because newspaper stuff, but I like to think that the like guy who comes in at the end is just covering.
I like to think that he shot himself in the head and then only pretended to shoot himself in the head, and then in the bed that those 2 months, it was just a bunch of pillows he put there. Yeah. with a hat. And then he snuck out the window and it's like, tee-hee-hee. And then for some reason he haunted them for a couple of months and then stole the husband. So that is Edith Wharton's Afterword. Spooky. Big thumbs up from me.
Oh, yeah. This was a really good story.
Highly recommend it. Pick up a copy. Check it out. It's in like every single collection under the sun. But Willow, what is our next story? It should be really easy title for you to remember.
Yeah, it's my story. It's the story about me. No, it's The Willows by Algernon Blackwood.
By Algernon Blackwood. I love The Willows. I love Algernon Blackwood. We will be talking The Willows. We'll be talking The Weird. We'll be talking, hopefully, a little T. Kingfisher, because she wrote a semi-sequel to The Willows. That's one of my favorite novels of the last few years. So great.
This is a long story.
It is a long story. It's a novelette, I would say.
Yep.
But it's also Algernon Blackwood. And so like between this and The Wendigo, he wrote two of the like just more like genuinely creepy stories from that era. So
yes. Maybe we'll get to talk a bit about the name Algernon.
Algernon, Flowers 4, Mice, mm-hmm. Charlie, the movie adaptation of Flowers for Algernon called Charlie, starring Cliff Robertson. I can't remember who played Charlie. In any case, I watched it in junior high.
Flowers, that's a horror story that we should cover at some point.
Or Jack and Algernon from Importance of Being Earnest. All kinds of Algernons.
Yep.
Count your Algernons, buddy, because we're going
into... It's such a good name.
We're going into the Black Woods to hang out with our buddy Algy. But that's next
time. I have a question before we get to the next time. Is that his birth name?
I'm assuming it is. Algernon was a pretty common name back in the day.
Just that Algernon Blackwood is such a D&D character name.
It does sound made up. I will give you that. It sounds like a name that someone made up for themselves. Hold on. Algernon... Blackwood. Algernon Blackwood. Oh, there's some great photos of him. His actual name? Algernon Henry Blackwood. So,
that's even cooler.
His father was Sir Stevenson Arthur Blackwood. His mother, Harriet Dobbs, was the widow of the 6th Duke of Manchester. So, a British man. Did I break your brain? I don't know what's going on. Why'd you stop talking?
No, I'm reading the paragraph, and it just... was considered by some enthusiasts and experts as the greatest, H.P. Lovecraft, who did not impress Blackwood.
Let's hear it for Algernon Blackwood. All right, so next episode, the man who was not impressed by H.P. Lovecraft. We'll be back with The Willows by Algernon Blackwood. Until then, I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro
Del Toro
time. Bye. I couldn't lean into my microphone for that one because it's not recording.